Go to kpfk.org/cars or call 877-573-5288. That's 1-877-KPFK-AUTO to learn more.
KPFK, Los Angeles.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. We live in a global world. We are all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities, are responding. We also discuss the relationship between art and politics. Now to news headlines.
From across the nation and around the world, for Pacifica Headlines, I'm Jesse Lent. Footage of Turkish police tear-gassing protesters at May 1st demonstrations in Istanbul today, courtesy of Al Jazeera. The CHD Lawyers Group, which was at the May 1st rallies, told the BBC that police have arrested more than 500 demonstrators. The president of the Turkish Workers' Party, Erkan Bas, was among those arrested for trying to march to Taksim Square. Bas said in a statement that blocking access to Taksim Square was, quote, illegal and called for it to be reopened. May 1st is a public holiday in many countries to mark International Workers' Day, or Labor Day, when workers' unions traditionally rally around wages, pensions, inequality, and progressive political issues. Demonstrations like the ones in Istanbul have been taking place around the world. Working people refuse to pay the price for Donald Trump's war in the Middle East. The European Trade Union Confederation, which represents 93 trade union organizations in 41 European countries, wrote in a statement to the AP. Today's rallies show working people will not stand by and see their jobs and living standards destroyed. President Trump rejected a deal Iranian officials sent to Pakistani mediators overseeing peace talks last night to end the war with the United States, telling the New York Times, quote, they want to make a deal, but I'm not satisfied with it. Speaking in front of the White House today, President Trump praised the U.S. blockade of the Strait of Hormuz and all Iranian ports, calling it, quote, unbelievable, powerful, 100%. He added, we're negotiating with them. Their teams are unbelievably disjointed, but we are negotiating. According to Al Jazeera, Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said his country remains open to diplomacy if Washington alters its, quote, expansionist approach and threatening rhetoric. President Trump's war in Iran is as unpopular among Americans as the Iraq War during the year of peak violence in 2006 and the Vietnam War in the early 1970s, according to a new Washington Post ABC News Ipsos poll, with 61% of Americans saying that using military force against Iran was a mistake, and fewer than 2 in 10 Americans believing that the U.S. actions in Iran have been successful. The young daughter of Hussein al-Sati, one of the Lebanese civil defense paramedics killed by Israeli strikes in southern Lebanon on Tuesday, tells her mother, quote, don't cry, mom, my dad was a hero, at a funeral service for al-Sati and the 2 other medics killed, Hussein Gadbouni and Hadi Daher, that drew a crowd of hundreds. The 3 men were reportedly trapped under the rubble in an Israeli strike on the town of Majdal Zun. 2 other people were killed in the attack, footage and reporting courtesy of Al Jazeera. Nabi Berri, a top Lebanese lawmaker, has expressed reservations about direct negotiations with Israel, a policy led by Lebanese President Joseph Aoun and Prime Minister Nawaf Salam. Berry, a Hezbollah ally, told the Ashark al-Assad newspaper that the so-called ceasefire that President Trump helped broker between Lebanon and Israel has only allowed Israel to, quote, escalate its aggression without any intervention from the U.S. administration. Where is this truce, he asked. And has Israel ceased its annihilation of towns, its demolition of homes, its wanton shredding of the blood of children, women, and the elderly, and its obstruction of ambulance teams attempting to rescue the wounded and transport them to hospitals, or to retrieve those trapped beneath the rubble? And Wednesday's Supreme Court ruling in the case of Louisiana versus Callis, undoing a key provision in how states draft congressional maps under the key civil rights statute, the Voting Rights Act, has already started to have substantial political effects. In Alabama, Republican Governor Kay Ivey announced today that she's calling a special legislative session to begin Monday in hopes that the Supreme Court allows the state to change its U.S. House map ahead of the November midterm elections. Louisiana has already suspended its May 16th congressional primary in order to allow time for lawmakers to approve new U.S. House districts. Those are the latest Pacifica headlines. For the Pacifica Network, I'm Jesse Lent.
Those were the news headlines from Pacifica Radio. You are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumphy. Workers of the world, unite! And happy May Day. I hope you had a wonderful day. Today on Sojourner Truth, we break down and discuss the Supreme Court's devastating decision in Louisiana versus Calais, and then check on what that decision and other current events in the United States signify in the authoritarian playbook. All this and more on Sojourner Truth. The Supreme Court finally did to voting rights what it did to reproductive rights in Roe in the case of Louisiana versus Calais. And the impacts cannot be overstated as the United States takes a giant step away from the goal of multiracial democracy. Glad to be joined by Carmen Daugherty to help us understand what the SCOTUS decision in Louisiana versus Calais means, and what, if anything, we can do about it. Carmen Daugherty is the executive director of Advancement Project, a movement lawyer, community-centered civil rights organization based in Washington, D.C. Greetings, Carmen. So good to have you on with us again.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
So, we wish it were happier times that brought us together, but we are looking at what has happened in this latest Supreme Court disaster, Louisiana versus Calais, and wanting to get a sense for people, because I think it's still hard for people to understand what this case is about and why so many of us are really concerned and strategizing on how we push back. So I want to start at the very beginning. I'm not going to start singing Sound of Music, a very good place to start. And start with the Voting Rights Act itself, because I think there definitely, just because of time, not because of intelligence, right? But there's definitely a divide and understanding for people of what the voting rights is. So talk with us about what is this voting rights? Why did we need it, this Voting Rights Act?
And then I'm going to take it even a little further back, right? I want to talk about Reconstruction, right? So, and then after the Civil War, we got this 15th Amendment to our Constitution, which guaranteed Black men the right to vote. And then we know the story of Reconstruction, Black political participation surged. We had Black elected officials, senators, governors, mayors, a new constitutions, a public education system that included Black children. And then you saw the white supremacist backlash immediately, the Ku Klux Klan, right? And then the systematic dismantling of that progress that Reconstruction brought to Black Americans. So we know, like, Jim Crow laws, not accidental. It was engineered voter suppression to eliminate Black political power. We know the stories of the literacy tests, the poll taxes, the grandfather clauses, the land ownership. Yeah. And so over that time, we saw the Supreme Court, you know, upheld or enabled the system and it hollowed out the promise of the 15th Amendment that we've fought hard for during Reconstruction or right after Reconstruction. So that laid the groundwork for the Voting Rights Act. You know, our people are like, enough is enough. It didn't come out of nowhere. It was won through sustained grassroots struggle. Organizations like the NAACP and SNCC organized voter registration drives under constant threat, violence, death, bombings. And so the Voting Rights Act was like the pinnacle of our civil rights struggle. It was the promise or the beginning of a promise for us for participation in this democratic experiment. And we saw activists like Fannie Lou Hamer, right, expose this brutality of disenfranchisement to the nation. And so people literally lost their lives for the Voting Rights Act. They lost their lives on that bridge. Our people have been shot at, houses burned down, families harassed for the Voting Rights Act. And with this decision yesterday, it was basically the nail in the coffin for the Voting Rights Act.
Thank you for sharing that context, because I think it's important for people to understand. Like, even as people think about, as you said, Fannie Lou Hamer, Kwame Ture, and so many others, right? It's ridiculous that we are even in this position, but we are. And we've seen them clawing and clawing away at the Voting Rights Act almost since it came into being, right? And since it was enacted. I think because people have still voted, that they may have been missing what has been happening. And so, yes, we had a 15th Amendment that already gave Black men at the time the right to vote. Then when women got the right to vote, then Black women jumped in and were part of that as well. And it was extended to folks of all genders. See if that actually continues under this regime as well. But even with that, there still has had to be a fight, as you've pointed out, the fight to get to the point of the Voting Rights Act, and then a fight to hold on to the Voting Rights Act. It didn't just say that people could vote. The Voting Rights Act provided opportunity and way for people, for Black people in particular, of course, extending to all other marginalized groups, because that's what we do as Black people, right? But for Black people in particular, to be able to make sure that we had the power of representation and access to resources that the right to vote provides. And that where that wasn't happening, that we had some kind of redress. We had some kind of way of fighting back, of suing, of making it clear that there are issues that are keeping us from being able to exercise that right to vote. We already have seen that there was a pushback on Section 5. Now this pushback on Section 2. Help us to unpack that a little bit, because I think that also is a piece that people may not be clear about.
That's right. Like you were saying, the Voting Rights Act, you know, what made it so powerful, it didn't just ban discrimination. It actually prevented it. It actively prevented it. And I want to talk about some key provisions of the Voting Rights Act that matter. And I'll tell the story of how it's been eviscerated and you know, death by a thousand cuts. In this case, really three giant chops over the last couple of decades here. But you had these key provisions like the preclearance, right? So this preclearance provision was huge because jurisdictions with a history of discrimination had to actually get federal approval before changing voting laws. So this preemptive piece of the Voting Rights Act actually prevented active discrimination against voters. And then you had the federal oversight provision, which allowed federal examiners to register voters directly, going beyond the state's registration. And then you had the suspension of discriminatory tests like literacy tests, right, that I mentioned before. So it wasn't just a law, you know, we talked about it was like the result of generations of resistance against meeting support of federal enforcement power, right? So the will of the people actually supported by our federal government, which is upside down now. Right. And it showed us that, you know, I say like the constitutional rights alone weren't enough. They required a statute that gave us active protections and enforcement. And like you said, political power and will. So we've been on this journey, this death by a thousand cuts. for a minute now, right? It started with the first major blow in 2013 in Shelby County v. Holder. And the court gutted that Section 5 preclearance requirement, right, by throwing it out. You know, the majority of the court argued that the country had changed, but really ignored the ongoing reality of racial discrimination in voting. So you'll see this as a theme, this color blindness, this white Christian nationalist view of you know, white supremacy. And now it's colorblind. So the immediate consequences were swift. So states that previously covered, who were covered under this preclearance, rushed to pass voter suppression laws, which were strict ID laws, polling place closures, voter purges, literally taking thousands of voters off their rolls and not either telling these folks, so it made it even harder to get them registered in time for elections. We're seeing that in states like Virginia and Georgia and Florida and Texas currently. And, you know, that decision on Shelby didn't just weaken the VRA. It really shifted the burden, because before the states had to prove their laws weren't discriminatory, and after communities had to prove discrimination after harm already occurred. So again, it's like, it's too late, right? Like we had to prove it ourselves. And then the second kind of cut here was the narrowing and the beginning of a hint of our Section 2 evisceration of the VRA, of the Brnovich decision versus the Democratic National Committee. And so we got preclearance gone. And then so Section 2 became this civil rights tool, the primary tool for us to fight discrimination. And then Brnovich came along and made that tool so much harder to use. And the court, again, created these vague guideposts that make it harder to prove discriminatory impact. It normalized burdens on voters, like long lines, travel distances. That was normalized under the Brnovich decision. And then it minimized the significance of racially disparate impacts, right? So the message from this court was like, even if a law disproportionately harms Black voters, it can still stand. It's all good. So then we have this final blow, and that's the Calais decision. So, you know, we say the VRA was already on life support after the Brnovich decision around Section 2. And then here comes Calais that just basically took away the ability to challenge discriminatory districting on voting practices. So it's making it, even though Judge Alito, this MAGA court talks about this, we still have Section 2, but you have a name. Everything else is hollowed out in that Section 2 now. And it's basically forcing communities to prove discriminatory intent, which is a very high standard for us to do, especially when a court has already said political gerrymandering is okay. So now you have a court that says, you know, you can have all white districts. That's all right. Because the case in Louisiana was about Louisiana, right? And Louisiana trying to draw only one, excuse me, having two majority Black districts because they only had one out of six, right? And now the court's saying, no, you can't even have that. And so, you know, we should talk about, like, what does that mean? What is the impact on communities? And you and I both know that it stifles our ability to have a democracy or have a say as Black people in our local elections, our federal elections. We'll have no representation because they've taken away districts that fairly represented Black residents.
And I think that can't be overstated, right? Because there is a notion, again, when people maybe, you know, don't know for various reasons. The work that I do is a lot with Black immigrants. Some Black immigrants have been here for a while. Kwame Ture was a Black immigrant. He got it. You know what I'm saying? Shirley Chisholm was a Black immigrant. She got it. But they were here for a long time, you know, since they were little. But when you have some folks that have come in newer, and especially in this sort of post-Obama time period, there may be confusion about whether or not this society is able, ready, willing to operate in a way that uplifts Black folks and that gives Black people our due without there having to be a law behind it. But we know that's not the case. And this colorblind conversation that sounds really good, right, and especially to folks who want to believe that, you know, people are like God and are looking at everyone without regard to race and who and what, you know, it sounds really good. But talk about how realistic that is in spite of the Obama, right? In spite of having Kamala Harris run for vice president and, you know, having the largest CBC that there ever has been, that is not meaning that anti-Blackness and voter suppression as it pertains to Black people is not in full effect. Because if it was not in full effect, we'd see much more representation. Talk about that a little bit, please.
White supremacy is alive and well in this country. We have never reckoned with slavery. We are still in this denial phase as a country that we ever enslaved people. So, you know, that's point one. So, you know, to think that we are in, you didn't quite say this, but like this idea that we're in a post-racial society is a false narrative. And it's one that white Christian nationalists want us to believe so they can consolidate power as authoritarians do to keep power away from us and keep us enslaved, really, whether it's through lack of healthcare, lack of education, and over-policing. And so, you know, what the Supreme Court continues to do is to chip away at this idea that there was ever discrimination, that there was ever enslaved people in this country, that let's ignore data around Black and brown bodies in this country. So it's been very frustrating, right? When maybe frustration is not the word. I think our ideals is we do want to live in a multiracial democracy. And I think we have to fight for that. This promise of our democracy has never been fulfilled, right? And we argue too that that Constitution was never written for us. In fact, we were written out of most of it. And so it's important for us to remember that we haven't changed that Constitution, right? That's still, you know, the 13th Amendment that still allows us to be indentured service in the prison system, right? So I think it's a little absurd to think we are in a post-racial society when we see cases like this that so viscerally, that we can have whole counties, whole states that completely disregard Black ballots and Black voters to ensure that the legislature remains white, remains mostly men, right? And remains at the will of white Christian nationalists.
Absolutely. And it, you know, it bears upon the resources, the power that Black communities have. The multiracial democracy doesn't just mean that you have this white supremacist billionaire Epstein class running the rest of us. Like that is not, and just because there's multiracial people in the country does not make it a multiracial democracy. And so this decision has bearing on people's everyday living as it pertains to their representation, wherever districts are. So, of course, congressional, but even when we think about the local districts, county districts, districts within the state, school districts, like this could impact all of those spaces and could make them look very different, much more white, much more male, as you've pointed out. And that representation matters. And then the resources as well, because when we don't have people from our communities that are in these legislative houses, that are in these city councils and other spaces, that impacts how resources are shared or not shared, what budgets look like, including how much is invested in harm and how much is invested in care. Let's talk about how this impacts Black communities directly.
That's right. When you have this racial gerrymandering, it cracks Black communities. Right. These at-large election systems will cancel out Black votes. And, you know, these systems don't block voting outright, but they dilute its power, you know, because folks will say like, oh, I can still vote. But that vote literally will mean less than you think it does, if anything, in these communities that are racially gerrymandered by white electeds. So, you know, you have these representatives who don't look like us, who don't come from our communities, who are now maybe responsible for a lot larger swath of a jurisdiction. And that person, that white person office will historically favor those other communities that look like them, right? And so it is, like you said, our Black and brown communities will receive less resources for let's say, healthcare, for schools, for public works, right? What's going to happen to keeping to our getting our streets clean, right? Everything will be a larger fight to have our voices heard in places that shouldn't have been that hard in the beginning. So this will have real-time effects in our communities and how services are distributed, how budgets are made. We ask folks constantly to go to budget meetings, have your voices heard. And if those representatives feel like your voice actually has no power, this case actually does, it dilutes our power, then they're going to listen to us even less than they did before. So it really does, it will affect our day-to-day, our representation, and how people actually serve us, folks that are elected, that we did not vote for.
Yeah, when the people that control the resources and the people that make the decisions are not representative of the people that are in those areas. You know, you think of some areas in the South where Black people are huge proportions, including a state like Louisiana, and yet have been reduced to such little representation. It is colonialism. It's colonialism in this time period, in which this one community that is often naturally outsizing itself, right, through this process of colonizing others. And I think, again, thinking about when we look at other countries and we say, you know, whether they're a democracy, they're a dictatorship, they're authoritarian, one of the things that we look at is voting and whether or not the voting system is fair and, you know, the voting system is free. And I think that if we looked at what's happening now in the United States, certainly we could not say that free and fair elections are happening throughout the country. We already see that there are states that are redistricting in anticipation, and some we can see moving after this decision to crack, as they call it, Black districts, to separate them, to take them and break them up and push people into districts where they will be diluted. The same day as this decision, a map passed in Florida, a voting map, a redistricted map that did just that. And we can see that that will be happening across the country. What work are you all doing, Advancement Project and those of the warriors that are helping us on this electoral front, to push back against that or to think about how we can join in making sure that we save as many districts as we can in spite of this decision?
That's right. And I don't want to leave people hopeless, because we're never hopeless, right? We are smart. We are organized. We are powerful in our numbers. So there isn't a single fix here, right? The old enforcement model is gone for our Voting Rights Act. And the response has to be multi-layered, from federal, state, local, and political. So, I think the most obvious one that we are talking about, we have a pretty significant midterm election upon us. We got to vote. We got to get out there and vote, right? That's important. And then we really have to rebuild these federal protections, but stronger than before. The baseline answer is still federal legislation, but it can't just restore the past. So we look at the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. It creates this new pre-clearance formula tied to current discrimination. And then you pair it with broader standards like the Freedom to Vote framework, which clears protections against voter dilution, what we've been talking about. So, but even if that's passed, the court that decided Calais may narrow it again. So there's always that power at the state level. We have to build power at the state level. That is so important. Expanding our state's voting rights acts, like in California, New York, and Washington have models, lowering the burden of proof compared to like the federal Section 2 that doesn't really exist anymore, creating new state level preclearance systems. So really focusing on what power is at the state level, and then really just, you know, move upstream, control the rules by winning the bodies that write them. So focusing on state legislatures, focusing on secretaries of states, the county election boards. One that I don't think our people think about enough are school boards, right? That's a pipeline to base building, to organizing. And those school boards have a lot of power. So we really should be moving upstream and looking at these hyper local elections right now to start building power in our communities. It's a core voting rights strategy right now. So those are some of those pieces that feel right and that we'll be working on at Advancement Project. And then litigation shifts, right? As movement lawyers, litigation is a tool we use. It's not our first go-to, but we recognize the power in litigation. And so really experimenting with some new theories and new forums around state constitutional claims, looking at other federal statutes for discrimination, things we experiment with is administrative law changes. And I think we should start looking at international human rights framing, right? There are other countries, we're so U.S.-centric that we don't learn enough from other struggles and other emerging democracies that have been through so much more than us in creating their democracies and their constitutions, which oftentimes are stronger than ours. So, I think we're at a tipping point in authoritarianism. We're not quite at consolidation, but I think we have to go all out and all of these various strategies to protect our right to vote and to continue on the path of a multiracial democracy.
Absolutely. And, God, the people need to speak up, to speak out, to be behind, because everything that we do has to also have the people. And so I'm so glad that you joined us today, Carmen, because if the people don't understand what's going on, it's harder for them to get engaged, right? It's just right. Harder to engage when you don't know what's happening and you don't understand how it impacts your day to day and what it means about your power. Because if people are unhappy about what is going on around them, so much of that is dictated by policy. So much of that is dictated by laws and by rules that are made by people that we vote in or don't vote in, right? But become our elected representatives. And so this is so very important. Our people knew that. And that's why they fought for so long to be able to have that right to vote.
That's right.
Thank you, Carmen, so very much. Have a wonderful, wonderful rest of your day.
Thank you.
That was Carmen Darty, Executive Director of the Advancement Project, talking with us about the Supreme Court's recent devastating decision to gut the Voting Rights Act in Louisiana versus Calais. You are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumpy. Pleased to be joined in this segment by Stephen Gardner. Stephen Gardner is Principal Research Advisor at Political Research Associates. He has been researching and writing in opposition to the politics of bigotry, violence, and authoritarianism since the early 1990s. Greetings, Stephen. So wonderful to have you back on. Long time no talk.
As always, Nana, it's so great to be here. It's been a minute and a half and so much to talk about. We'll never get through it.
We'll never get through it. So much to talk about. So I'm going to try to first start with what you think are some of the top lines, some of the things that we need to be looking at now. We have you on and we talk about what is happening in terms of authoritarianism in the United States, something that some people like my dad, who's living now in Ghana, never thought they would ever see. But they're seeing it and knowing what they're seeing. And I think it's important to always bring it back to the conversation about authoritarianism as we seek to navigate what we're dealing with in this country. And so as we look, at all that's happened, and it's so much, what would you say are the top three things that we should be looking at right now, knowing that there's many more?
Okay, so three things. Gutting of the Voting Rights Act happening almost as we speak, coming out of the Supreme Court decision. We're looking at fallout from the Iran war, which continues to be unsettled and is already, even if it ended today, would have massive repercussions on all sorts of issues related to U.S. politics and the well-being of the world, frankly. And then finally, the increasing desperation of the Trump regime, given how their popularity is sinking, and given that the sort of the model for their regime, the Orban regime in Hungary, went down in electoral defeat in the last few months.
Okay, so I'm going to take them in reverse order. Those are three good ones. I'm going to take them in reverse order. So we know that this regime actually has been in close contact with that government in Hungary. I'm sure they were shocked and appalled. And there definitely has been signs of this increasing desperation. Talk to us a little bit about that and what that means and what that could mean as we are thinking about not just these elections that are coming up, but you know what we're looking at over the next at least 3 years.
Yeah, well, I mean, the idea of the Hungarian model was one of sort of contested authoritarianism. In other words, you're not totally, you know, moving in and taking over everything. You're not even aspirationally totalitarian. You're just trying to stack the deck so that your opponents are most likely to lose. And what has happened in Hungary is that even though the opponents had the deck stacked against them, they still won because of the unpopularity of the Orbán regime, given that it was just unable to deliver on the promises that it had made. And this, of course, in any even quasi-democratic society is the situation you run up against. It's one of the reasons why parties on the, if you win a presidential election, you're likely to lose the next congressional election in the United States. It's because it's, you know, in a democratic society, people are always looking for a better deal. Nothing wrong with that, but it's a dynamic that we have to be able to recognize. And the Hungarian government wasn't able to clamp down hard enough to make it impossible. This is the situation the Trump administration is in now, trying to find a path by which they can control the vote without simply declaring that they won, because there's no guarantee that the dominant institutions would support such a clearly illegal declaration. I mean, you know, we want to think both the best and the worst of our dominant institutions, but they do still have their own vested interests. And a permanent dictator is probably not something that those institutions, Congress, the courts, and so on, really want, unless it's one that they can control. And even then, we're probably talking about corporate elites and not political elites who have their own fish to fry back home with their constituencies, if we're talking about Congress, or their own prestige and power, if we're talking about the courts. So the situation that the Trump administration is in is their popularity is going down and down and down. An authoritarian regime that is trying to establish itself, this is still only a year old, usually moves with popular support. Well, that has barely been there from the time of the election and increasingly is dissolving in the reality of big promises, no results. Hardly surprising, given the promises were grounded either in Trump's ego or the idea that somehow it was low-paid, unsupported, undocumented immigrants who were causing people's pain and not corporate elites and rigged banking systems and the other ills of late capitalism. So this is the moment when the Trump regime has to say, well, what could we do? What can we get away with? So they're going to float all kinds of ideas, like let's surround polling stations with ICE agents so that people will be deterred from going to the polls. Let's make it so you have to show up at the polling station with a birth certificate or a passport, which, you know, many, many people do not have in order to vote, and so on. So what kinds of authoritarian measures can we use to clamp down in a way that will make it harder for the opposition to unseat our razor-thin congressional majorities and potentially start seizing back the reins of government, you know, preventing the worst excesses that the regime continues to signal that it would like to engage in. So that's the first thought there.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's something that I think many of us have been going back and forth with some of our comrades about, you know, because people are like, oh, well, they'll just suspend the thing completely and they just won't have elections. I'm like, look, these people can't get that low down, you know. They are lower than a snake's belly. And at the same time, that would be so jarring to the general public that these other tactics they're using, as you've indicated, whether it be signaling that they will have ICE or other body snatchers at the polling places, whether it is the SAVE Act, whether it is, you know, requiring all kinds of other hoops and loops. They'll bring back the jelly beans, you know what I'm saying, before they say we're not doing this at all. The poll tax will return. And we see what's happening with the VRA and this latest decision by the Supreme Court with, the you know, Roberts as the chief. And this has been Roberts' main thing. How does this fit into what you're talking about now? This decision in Louisiana versus Calais, which, you know, just runs roughshod over the sacrifices, including death. You know, there are rivers that continue to have the DNA of people who were murdered. People were blown up. People were injured, wounded. Little girls died for this Voting Rights Act and the ability of Black people to have this power over representation and resources that seems to have just been gutted in this decision. Talk to us more about that.
Well, of course, it's been not just this decision. It's been a long road that has continued, even when Democratic administrations were in power, because the court's center of gravity has been shifting right for decades. The Voting Rights Act is like the key piece of power implementation. I mean, there was justice implementation in the Civil Rights Act, but it was the Voting Rights Act that made potential shift of power to shift proportional representation to Black folk in the United States. The provisions of the Voting Rights Act are what has the possibility and the reality of Justice Department and court supervision of states that have historically been horrible on creating barriers for Black people to vote, has been a check against rampant formal white supremacy in voting in the South and in other parts of the country as well. And this ruling basically says that, no, we have now reached a degree of racial equity in this country that if you try to enforce voting rights based on race, you are in fact discriminating based on race. I mean, the cognitive dissonance there that should be exploding in people's brains is the kind of thing that only a Justice Alito or someone of his ilk could conceptualize. And at the same time, there has been the previous ruling that there's no constitutional reason why you can't create gerrymandered districts based on trying to maintain the majority of one political party or another. Basically, you can't take race into consideration, but you can make it so one party can win automatically over another, or if not automatically, at least, again, stacking the deck against one political party or another. Now, you and I both know that the majority of the Democratic Party are not people that we would trust with decisions around racial and social justice. Nonetheless, it's clear that it is the one party, not the other, that is mostly building on authoritarian models. True enough, it's going to be a push to get the other to try to, the Democratic Party to, if they win, to reverse the kinds of authoritarian measures that this regime has enacted. It's really hard for a government to let go of any tool of controlling the population, including one of the things I know you want to talk about, which is surveillance. So this is a horrible decision, an unethical decision, a racist decision, and a decision that basically pretends that white supremacy no longer exists, even while the regime is openly saying that that the important thing is the civil rights of white people. And I believe in the civil rights of all people. So I think if you do away with the key provisions of the Voting Rights Act, if you do away with trying to have proportional representation in the key body of the U.S. government, the Congress, then you are basically saying, yes, this is a white nationalist state.
Which, yes, clearly is their goal. Like, you cannot have a multiracial democracy in this country without those provisions of the Voting Rights Act. That is not, you know, conjecture. That is hundreds of years proven, right? That cannot happen. And so clearly, you know, clear what the aim is there. Let's shift to the first thing that you talked about in your list of three, the war on Iran. We know that presidents in the past has also just looked up and said, I'm engaging in this military activity that I'm going to call something else, you know, whether I'm calling it police activity in the case of the Korean War, whether I'm calling it a preemptive strike, right? But this seemed to have been particularly problematic and particularly unfolding in this authoritarian playbook way. Talk about that, please, Stephen.
Yeah, I mean, this is hard to do in short form, but I'm going to lay out a couple of points. Yes, of course, there's been a creep of claims by the executive authority, by the president and the White House, that they can fight any war that they want to fight. However, historically, even under the most, the worst examples, under the Bush administration, let's say, there was still an effort to justify the war, in some, even if it was by lies, but still, those lies were pointed at the American people and at Congress to try to sell the idea that this war is justified. You know, and there were goals, however incoherent. In this case, the administration, the only conclusion that we can come to based on the cycling through of potential motivations was, one, they don't like people who disagree with them, and two, they're willing to kill them to show that they were willing to kill people who disagree with them. This is the basic problem of Iran for the United States. You know, even if you don't approve of the way they run their business, it's their business. And you might want to support democratic forces or minority rights or women's rights in Iran. But nonetheless, it's their business. And the idea that we're going to assassinate their leaders through bombing and indiscriminately bomb portions of their cities and so on to try to force them to do what we want to do, it's basically the bullies exercise in saying, see, I'm willing to hurt anyone. And this is a message partially to Iran, but even much more so to other countries, other cities, other counties, other jurisdictions in and out of the United States, as was the Venezuela attack, that the United States believes in, not in some kind of international legal order, however imperfect, but in might makes right, and do what we say or we'll kill you. So this is the foundational idea of a certain kind of authoritarianism that is not technocratic. It is militarist. It is, we believe that force is the most important thing, and law and ethics and norms and cooperation and even mutual benefit can all just go to hell.
Yeah, and we see that combined with that white Christian nationalism flair. It really feels like people are not seeing the techno part of this authoritarianism, that and how that is really gathering data, weaponizing data. It's really frightening if people think about it. And, you know, surveillance is just so key to authoritarianism that we would hope that people would pay more attention.
The premise of personal privacy, this is not a convenience. This is a profound political position that says you can have conversations, even conversations that are outrageous if they're hypothetical. If I mean, you know, it's illegal to plan to overthrow the government of the United States or to hurt someone or so on. But to talk in terms that include dark humor, that include all the full range of things that human beings talk about, and not have to worry that the regime is going to be spying on you and indict you for something that was not serious. I mean, this is not hypothetical. We've got The former director of the FBI, James Comey, who's being re-indicted for putting some seashells on the beach and taking a photo that said 8647. 47, of course, is second presidency. And 86 is an kind of an old school slang for dump it in the trash. The Trump administration and the Justice Department are now claiming this is a death threat. And this guy has to be charged with threatening the president. The absurdity, it's like something that would have to be a joke just a few years ago. Who would make a death threat like that? I mean, this is makes no sense to anyone. And this is coming from someone who is part of the cultural and political elite, someone who was director of the FBI, for God's sake. Yeah. And the rest of us, of course, have way lower considerations. And in fact, even our attempts to keep our communications private when they are explicitly political are now taken as evidence, as shown in the Prairie Land trial, that that we must be up to no good. Well, the fact that I don't want my conversations overheard by the federal government or any government or my political opposition, it doesn't mean that I'm plotting something illegal or immoral. It just means I don't want you to know what my strategy is. I don't want you to know what my tactics are. And I don't want you necessarily to even know what my feelings are unless I publish them. That is a protected right in the United States under the First and Fourth Amendments. In fact, being secure in your person and papers was a big issue in the American Revolution, where the British Crown tried to claim the right to seize people's papers and, you know, infiltrate their meetings and use informants. And all of this was something that angered people, as it should. This is without even touching on the ways in which we're entering into a world where absolutely everything that we do is being recorded, watched, and analyzed by machines that hallucinate. Even if they got things perfectly correct all the time, they don't. We know that AI systems make things up and they tell plausible stories, like children trying to justify the mess that they made to their mothers. This is a recipe for a dystopian future if we don't get this under control. And not just the Trump regime, but every regime of the last 25, 30 years and beyond has tried to increase the net amount of surveillance in the system. And this is not just at the federal government. This is, of course, counties and states and cities and neighborhoods and social media apps and corporations and advertising. And all of this is like one gigantic system that is putting the weight of constantly being watched and scrutinized upon us and generating normative behavior that is increasingly schizophrenic, to use a metaphor here, in its politics, where people are devolving into conspiracy theories and nihilism and or withdraw and sort of, I see nothing, nothing's wrong. I'm going to, you know, not pay any attention to politics because nothing can be done, sort of radical disengagement. All of that is the result of being constantly watched. We all know that constant surveillance is a pressure on us. And anyone who's been in an institution, I was in the Army, and this creates a kind of pressure that is unending, and it creates hypervigilance. It's not good for a healthy psyche. And it's certainly not good for a just society.
It certainly is not. I mean, you know, it's really not. I mean, we have people talking about feeling the cameras everywhere, feeling the cameras on, you know, at every light post, and feeling the cameras and the drones and all of that. And it does lead people to really not be well. Pushing back, because I think sometimes when we talk about all that is happening, that people kind of shrug their shoulders and do the withdraw, right? And so, yes, you can fawn and you can flee, but you can also fight. And so as we close, Stephen, give us some thoughts about ways that we can fight, even, you know, inside or outside of the political sphere.
Yeah, I mean, number one thing is do not disengage. Engage with your friends, with your family, with your coworkers, with your neighbors, whoever your people are. find them and engage with them and talk about these issues and talk about them directly and understand that that you're talking about them, although it could be construed as being somehow a problem for the administration. If we're all talking, this is our power. If we in isolation, we die. In community, we have capacity to push back and to take care of each other and to take care of ourselves. So that's number one. Number two is make an effort, a conscious effort, to take a breath before you share information that is outrageous, but you don't actually know that it's true. There's so much misinformation and disinformation that is in circulation that both intentionally bad, intentional lies, as well as people who are innocently sharing things because it's outrageous. Take a breath. Remember that rather than thinking of a conspiracy theory like Trump is staging these assassination attempts, think that people really do hate him and don't have a sense, because of they're isolated, of what real political opposition looks like and what they can do. Three, join something, a political party. Doesn't have to be Democrats. There's other opportunities. There's DSA, there's PSL, there's Working Families Party, there's issue-based organizations for the environment, for civil rights, for Black liberation, for queer rights. Get involved with people who care. And that's important. Important not just because only together can we make change, but it's important for each of us to not, again, be isolated. So first is personal contact, and then second is some kind of institutional contact. Third thing is... and I said, you know, disinformation. Then the final thing is, we look at Hungary. Authoritarianism was in power for almost two decades, and it went down. This regime is not inevitable. It is deeply, deeply unpopular, especially for only a year into a wannabe authoritarian regime. The actions that is taken in Venezuela, and particularly in Iran, the $4 plus a gallon gas, the inflation, the effects that are going to come into being after the election, but that we need to be aware of, like the gutting of Medicaid. All of this is deeply unpopular in this country. And it is possible to push this regime out. And then it's going to be an equally large task to keep the next one, even if it's from the other party, the other major party, to hold them account, to dismantle the authoritarianism that has been built into the system and to start once again moving away from instead of embracing white supremacy.
Thank you so very much. This regime is absolutely not inevitable. Really appreciate you, Stephen. Have a wonderful, wonderful rest of your day.
You too. Thank you.
You are listening to Sojourner Truth Radio with your host, Nana Jumpy. And that was Stephen Gardner, Principal Research Advisor at Political Research Associates. That's our show. I'd like to thank our guests, the Sojourner Truth team, including our dear sister, Margaret Prescott, our board operator, Ozzy Flamenco, and our producer, Gary Scott, and you for joining us. Let's get together at the same time and place next week for Sojourner Truth Radio. Be well.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson. You're listening to Radical Free Speech Radio, KPFK, in Los Angeles.
Tune in for some fresh raps and classic cuts right here on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles and beyond on some breakbeats and rhymes.
Breakbeats and rhymes. Big thanks, baby, yo.
Breakbeats and rhymes.
Hey, yo, yo, y'all can't stand right here. In his right hand was your man's worst nightmare. Loud enough to burst his right eardrum close range. The game is not only dangerous, but it's most strange.
Heard every Friday night from 10 to midnight.
Breakbeats and rhymes hosted by Rebels to the Grain.
Fridays from 10 p.m. to midnight.
Breakbeats and rhymes.
Breakbeats and rhymes.
KPFK, breakbeats and rhymes. It's good for your mind.
You know we stay hungry for them breakbeats and rhymes. A safe favorite for MCs to shine. I stay tuned in, yeah, all the time.